Blog Talk Radio.
Episode of Bigfoot Ground Zero. My name is Dave, and as always, thanks so much for tuning in. I know that you have a ton of things you could be doing, but the fact that you spend an hour with me here on the show means a lot, so thanks so much. It always makes it more fun putting it together. But I'm going to actually do a little squatching out in the field shortly. I'll be at the Olympic Project Public Expedition coming up here in the beginning of May. And I had a chance to meet some of these guys and gals at Sasquatch Summit. It was a great time. Man, they're great people. Definitely one of the more solid research groups out there. And, you know, as you heard with David Ellis when I had him on the interview a number of months ago, he talked about being the what's next, you know, research group. So a lot of groups are trying to find Sasquatch, which is great, and they are too. But they take it to a whole other level as far as research goes. And I won't, you know, get into any of the things that I was kind of privy to, because I certainly wouldn't want to betray anyone's trust or, you know, give away any, I wouldn't say trade secrets, but, you know, kind of. But they're the what's next crowd. And, you know, what that means is when Sasquatch is officially scientifically discovered, then they will have had a plan put together on what to do next. And it's kind of a neat idea. They have some folks who are well-respected in the community, you know, scientists and other researchers, people from different backgrounds. You know, I won't get into all of it. But again, I appreciate the fact that, you know, they've spoken to me about some things. I'll keep the privacy, but I can tell you that the group is the real deal. Now, when I'm out there, I'm going to, you know, obviously do some field recording. I will interview some folks, you know, hopefully get some time with people, you know, even if it's 15 minutes here or there, and just put together a program based on that expedition. So I thought I'd throw it out there. I'm certainly going to get some feedback from that, I'm sure. And I'm sure some people who I meet when I'm out there, you know, will have a few things to say. But it's going to be a good time. I'm looking forward to it. So this interview coming up is with a man called Gerald Mills. Now, Gerald is one of these guys that is very – it's not that he measures his words. He's one of these people that uses words when it's necessary and says things clearly and concisely. Right, so he's kind of a guy that you want on your side because, A, he'll keep you from, you know, embellishing, keep you from saying everything in the woods is Bigfoot. I think you're going to like this interview because it's probably one of the more scientific we've done. This guy's done research on, you know, specifically with this, we're going to talk about teeth marks and bone piles. Now, there have been other people out there who've noticed, you know, bone piles, not structures, but just the way that things are placed potentially when an animal is consumed out in the wild. But Gerald takes it a step further, and he talks about specific bite marks, the patterns, you know, how certain animals do certain things, and we'll get into it. And I found this really interesting. You know, it's really the science behind the sighting that I want to talk about on the show. This is exactly my thought process and where I want to be when conducting an interview with somebody who's actually in the field scientifically, right? So we've had other folks on the show. Chris Spencer comes to mind, a few other people, and if I'm forgetting people, that Chris came to the top of my mind. But Gerald is one of those guys that just goes out and does, for lack of a better term, the Lord's work when it comes to research. He's the guy that's willing to do the stuff that most people won't do. What people might consider boring, what people might consider, you know, too nitpicky, too analytical, too down in the weeds. A lot of times we want to get out there and we want to just, you know, we want to tree knock and we want to, you know, howl and do all these things because it's more fun, I suppose. But it's not necessarily the kind of science that's going to get us to where we need to go. So I just want to thank Gerald for coming on the program. We're going to switch over now and go to the interview with Gerald, and then on the back end, we'll talk about a couple of things and go from there. All right. All right. So as promised, we have Gerald Mills on the phone. Gerald has been doing quite a bit of research in an area called X1. I know you have heard Chris Spencer talk about it a little bit in a couple of episodes he's been on with us, and I wanted to reach out to Gerald because Gerald has been doing what some would say kind of, and I like it, kind of boring research, just the nuts and bolts. I mean, from what I understand of speaking with Gerald in the past, and he knows that I don't mean anything derogatory by that or demeaning in any way, he is one of the guys that's out in the field, you know, taking the time to look at some of the things that we might pass up. And this is kind of what we're going to go over today in the interview. And you there, Gerald?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Okay.
So let's just kind of take a step back. You bring us into your world about, you know, how you got involved with Sasquatch, you know, what brought you into it, kind of bring to the table, you know, what it is as far as scientific research that you do, kind of your background. You have some interesting takes on bone piles and that sort of thing, and I'll let you speak to that. But just kind of bring us into your world about how you got started.
Well, I got started when I was quite young, back in the 60s. I liked to read, and I'd spend a lot of time in the library looking up everything I found. First, it was books about cryptozoology, just because they were interesting to me, and that's how I got into the subject of Sasquatch. And I read everything I could find about Sasquatch at the time, the main authors. I can't remember all of their names. But then I also got to see Roger Patterson's film at the Columbia Theater here where I live, when he was taking it around and showing it, which was really neat for a junior high kid.
Sure.
And that's how I got started in it. It was just an interest in the back of my mind. I eventually went to school, got a Bachelor of Science degree in wildlife biology. And although I haven't worked in that field because the availability of jobs at that time were kind of short, so I had to go elsewhere. But the work that I've been doing now has been fairly recent, probably in the last 4 or 5 years. Of course, my son and I, we go out to camping all the time, and we spend a lot of time up in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest and camping and everything. So always keeping my eyes open.
Sure. So now let me ask you this question. Going back a number of years to junior high school, and, you know, you see this Patterson-Gimlin film, and then you had a chance to see it, you know, outside of what's the show with Leonard Nimoy that, you know, that they had the Bigfoot show, and I can't think, In Search Of, right? So, you know, all these shows that are going on, you had a chance to see this, you know, in a different environment. There's the cryptozoology books, and there's all that before it was even cryptozoology, right? So they didn't really have kind of a name to call it. Explain to us what this was like, kind of going in the Wayback Machine. We've got the internet, we've got the flow of communication, we've got all of these thoughts and ideas going around. Comparing now to then, what was that like trying to get any information that you could on Sasquatch?
Well, like I said, the library was where I got most of my information, and well, that's probably the main thing. You might see something in a newspaper every now and then, but even TV shows, we didn't have all the recording devices and everything that we have today. So if you missed something, you missed it. So
yeah,
that's kind of the way it was. You know, we weren't an information society back then. I got to see that the Roger Patterson film in the theater when he was showing it, which was really great for me when I was a kid, and it's always been in the back of my mind. But I've always been in the outdoors too, and because we didn't have all the access to all the electronic stuff that we have nowadays, spent a
sure.
lot of time in the outdoors. That's what I did.
So now, so let's talk about that, but I have to ask you one question going back to the Patterson-Gimlin film when you saw that in the theater, and you know, there was Q&A about it. I'm sure there was more exposure. What are some of the things that you learned about that when he was there that people might not know now because it's been so long, and things that you recall during that moment that you're seeing this film and you know, hearing about it from the folks that were actually there to now, what are some of the things you think have been kind of forgotten?
That's a long time ago.
Okay. That's okay.
Trying to remember things like that, I don't even remember. I'm sure they had a question and answer session, but I don't remember it much. I just remember Patty walking across the screen and how neat that was. Of course, you know, I was in junior high at the time.
Sure.
So.
No, I get it. I'm just always fascinated because time passes and sometimes things get lost in translation. So, you know, compared to when things were fresh and happening, and I was just curious if there was anything that came to mind. So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that, let's talk about your bone piles, and I know there's data out there that you've put forth. I wanted to give this time to you to more or less talk about, and I don't know if it's theory, I don't know what you want to call it, some of this research that you do, but talk about these bone piles, talk about some of the ideas you have surrounding bite marks against the bones and what might have caused these and that sort of thing. So I'm going to take a step back and just start from A and go to Z.
Well, I got started in that. My wife actually signed us up for a class, me and my son. It was a human interest class about Sasquatch down at the community college. And I thought, okay, I'll take that. Sounds interesting. I'll just go for, you know, I think it lasted for about a month, one day a week or one evening a week. And the interesting thing, well, it was Mitch Townsend that taught the class. And like I said, I've read a lot about Sasquatch, and there wasn't too much new there presented. But right at the end of the class, he brought some bones in, and he told us how he had found them, and he displayed them, and we got to look at them real close. And he found them. They were in a stack. Together, and there was parts of the skeletons, they were deer, laying in the area close to them, but all these bones were in a stack, and it was rib bones and vertebrae and lower leg bones, but they were all stacked together between a couple of logs, and I looked at the bones, and there was a couple of impressions on them. They were real wide impressions. That looked interesting, and they kind of looked like a mark we would make on something if we bit into it. And so I just kind of filed that away because it was interesting, and I thought, well, that's something to keep an eye out for out in the woods. All of us go out in the woods and we'll find a bone, but the way I know, the way I used to be was I'd go out and I'd find a bone and I'd kick it around a little bit. I might pick up a skull or something and take a look at it, but I didn't really know what to look for or what the bones would look like when various animals fed on them. So anyway, this kind of just gave me an idea of something to look for out in the woods. Well, that summer later on, we were my son and I were camping up in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest east of Mount St. Helens. And long story short, we came down off of a ridge down into a meadow area where there was a spring, and I found a skull laying along there, and I thought, well, something killed and ate an elk here. And so we walked along this old logging skidder road, and back behind a huckleberry bush, I found a stack of elk bones. And all the ribs were intact, and the vertebrae were laying right next to them. It was all kind of a pile, and I looked at that, and I thought, well, that's interesting. You know, all these bones are whole. Rib bones don't last very long. That's been brought up in some discussions that I've had with other people. And rib bones, they get broken when predators get into them, like bears or wolves. We don't have any wolves around here. We've just got black bears. But when a predator gets into them and chews on them, they break up easy. They are not a durable bone, not like a leg bone or something like that. And so I'm looking at these, and all the ribs are whole, and the vertebrae are laying next to them, and everything's disarticulated, and everything's kind of in a pile. So I look at that, and I reached down and picked up one of the bones, and there were some big teeth impressions on it. And I thought, well, that's interesting. Those kind of look like something we would leave on a bone, only like twice as big. And that's what was impressive. And I looked at that bone a little bit, and something else I didn't notice, because I collected the bones that had these impressions in them and took them with us later on. But I also noticed on that same bone, the first one I picked up, there was some smaller teeth impressions, like would match a juvenile, you know, a young person, say, you know. And I'm thinking, well, these look like the kind of teeth marks we would leave, you know. And I thought right there, well, I need to find out a little more information on what animals do to bones. Well, that's what got me started looking into what animals do to bones. And so over the course of the last couple of years, because I think that was in 2014, I believe, last 3 years or so, I've been learning what animals do to bones. I can walk up to a kill now and pretty much determine what fed on it, predators, scavengers, and it's kind of become an interesting sort of hobby, you know.
Sure.
It is research, but you know, you don't find bones all the time, but it's something that you keep your eyes open for when you're out in the woods. And that's the interesting thing about the X1 area, is there were a lot of bones in that area. A lot of animals, for whatever reason, died or got killed. And I think most of them, the majority of them, were probably cougar kills. Some of them could have been from poachers in the area. There's not too much hunting that goes on there because it's kind of a limited area for hunting.
Sure. And, so it's oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
And anyway, that's what got me started in looking at these bones and looking at what various animals do to bones. So I've become pretty knowledgeable in looking at them, what it is that fed on them.
Sure. So let me ask you this question. I've noticed, you know, I'm not quite a woodsman, but I'm out pretty much a lot. And I will notice that you know, small animals will sometimes take their time to, you know, you'll find feces and whatever in the trail, and then they move on, kind of thing. Now, there's certain places that you're going to find things. Where would somebody look to find these bones? Because you've come across these before, and I'm not saying to look like, oh, okay, I've got to look under every nook and cranny, but if I'm in a certain area, is it, you know, dense behind certain bushes? Is it down in a depression? Where do these kills usually, where are they left so that if you're looking for that, you can maybe meander over and take a look for it, you're more apt to run into something?
Well, from what I've seen, like that first bone pile, it was elk, the first one that we found. It's an area where could possibly provide a good possible ambush point. And I think cougars probably utilize these areas too. And up in X1, a lot of what we found, like I said, were probably cougar kills. Now, I don't know the whole relationship between, say, if Bigfoot's out there, I don't know the relationship between them and the other apex predators as far as they relate to each other. I don't know if Bigfoot would just walk up to a cougar kill and take it away from a cougar or what. So those kind of things are still questions. They're still out there. I don't know the answer to those.
Sure.
But I can look at them and tell you whether a cougar fed on a kill. I can look at them and tell you whether a bear fed on a kill or if coyotes got into it.
Okay.
But, So
these bites were different. Were they bite marks or impressions, or because when I get my mind around this and I say, okay, I'm looking at a rib bone and I'm biting into this thing and I'm trying to break it, there's obviously a certain signature that's going to be left by my dental makeup in my mouth, right? So what was it that made you think it could be something? I'm just going to make the leap, anything like Sasquatch or kind of an ape or something like that.
Well, it was the shape of the impressions themselves. This is forensic evidence, and if I could have a forensic scientist look at it, I think they would probably be impressed by what is there. But they do that type of work all the time, and there have been studies on trying to determine what kind of predator fed on a kill or scavenger fed on a kill by the tooth impressions in the bones. And a lot of times, it's kind of vague. You can't, you know, there's just pits and dents and things like that. But what we found were actual wide, like incisor impressions. Like if you had a rib that you could bite into and didn't break your teeth,
okay.
They're marks like our incisors would leave. They're real wide. They're actually twice as wide as ours. I did all the measuring and everything. They're actually twice as wide as ours are. And I did some radiuses on the front of the shape of the mouth, and the radius is a lot bigger than our radius is on our teeth. I used my own teeth and face and everything for the comparison measurement.
Sure.
And so I got some idea how they compare with ours, and they look very much like our incisors. And the thing is, through the comparisons, I started comparing other carnivores, and in the order carnivora, and all carnivores have the same type tooth layout in front of their mouths. There's three incisors on each side because they measure the teeth in quadrants in the mouth. But so there's six incisors across the front of the mouth between the canine teeth. And there's only so much room between the canine teeth, even on a grizzly bear, which would be your biggest ones in this part of the, you know, in North America, to have the biggest incisors in there. And their teeth are still fairly small. There isn't that much distance in there. They aren't like a half inch to 5/8 of an inch wide. Their teeth are a lot smaller than ours are even. But we're in order primates. Primates have different type teeth. We only have four teeth in the front of our mouth between our cuspids or canines.
Mm-hmm.
So there's only two on each side instead of three on each side. And so just measuring and figuring out the distance of how wide teeth can be in a carnivore's mouth said that those teeth marks won't fit in a carnivore's mouth. And a carnivore also has their canines. They tend to make a half circle if they bite into the bone, or a oval shape if they bite through the bone, oval to round.
Sure.
And I found quite a few things where, like, a coyote has bitten through a shoulder blade or something like that. I have some pictures of them, and they just leave round marks about an inch and a half apart, inch and a quarter apart, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I also talked to someone that deals with skulls and skeletons. It's an interesting job he has. But he said that the carnivore's teeth, the incisors, are just built for nibbling. They aren't built for biting things. If they've got to bite something and break something, they use their molars, which are called carnassials in a carnivore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how they break the bones. Cougars tend to nibble, and you can see that in the meat along the edge of the bones. I've gotten pictures of them where they actually nibbled along the edge of the bones. You can see that. Their canines actually are up against the bone, and they're just nibbling the meat off with their incisors. So they can't hardly engage their incisors when they're biting something. Their canines come into play if they're biting something.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see canine marks, and these were not canine marks, and that's where the comparisons came out. Of course, I have to also get into the gnawing that rodents do, and there aren't any rodents big enough to make these kind of marks. And besides that, rodents gnaw. That's what
sure.
it's called.
Yep.
They score bone. If you pick up a bone and look at it, and it's got a whole bunch of scores on it, little scores and little nibbles all along the edges and everything, that's a rodent that does that.
Interesting.
Whereas these were actual bites. Like, it was just like if you bit into a sandwich.
Sure.
You know, or say a piece of cheese, because that's pretty solid piece of stuff. If you bit into a piece of cheese, you could see your incisor marks, and that's what we see on the edges of these bones.
So then, okay, so the question is, so it looks like something just took a chunk out. So the way that the bite mark is, and this is pretty telling. So what you're saying to me and to the folks that are listening is, look, we need to pay attention to this because this could be as significant as footprints, correct?
I didn't catch.
Oh, sure. So let me back up. I'm sorry. There might have been a...
Yeah, well, as significant as what?
Footprints.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes. It is, like I say, it is forensic evidence. It's something that could, if somebody was to take this evidence to court, they could use it for identification. We've found, my son and I have found outside of X1 over in Gifford Pinchot National Forest, east of Mount St. Helens, have actually found two elk kill sites. And one I stumbled on, you asked about the area and what it's like. Well, in both cases, they've been good ambush areas. One of them, I was following an elk trail down. I was actually elk hunting. And archery elk hunting, and I was following an elk trail down. I was going along the edge of a bunch of furs, and I found a bunch of animal fur or elk fur in the trail. And I thought, well, looks like something, you know, pulled some fur out of an elk. And it was right next to some fir trees, you know, younger fir trees where the branches go clear to the ground.
Sure.
And something could stand right between them or back in them and not be seen. If an elk herd was coming by, it would be easy to get one. And I don't know, and I can't say whether Bigfoot does that. I don't know. I think their description is that they are big enough to be able to do something like that. But cougars do it.
Mm-hmm.
Cougars are one of the few predators that will kill an adult elk. Black bears are usually opportunists. They'll go for the fawns or anything that's left over, so more scavengers. But anyway, following this trail down, and down in the bottom of the gully at the bottom of the trail, is where the animal finally succumbed to whatever it was that took it down, and that's where we found the bones. And that was the second elk kill that I found. And some of these bones with the teeth marks in them, the wide ones I was talking about along the edge of the rib bones, the ribs are, that's something that's important too, is if the ribs are whole and they've been actually disarticulated, you know, taken apart off of the vertebrae, most animals don't do that. A cougar will leave everything pretty much whole. They don't tear them apart.
Sure.
They will drag them around and the bones will fall off. But and a bear, they'll chew the ribs off about halfway down, so you end up with a bunch of ribs stuck on the vertebrae that are half eaten off, chewed off.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't find bones that are stacked together in an area that are whole rib bones that were taken loose, disarticulated from the vertebrae. You don't find those kind of things for most of your predators. They don't do those kind of things.
So you're talking about two things now. You're talking about the imprint of the teeth as they penetrate the rib bone. So there's that signature. But you're also talking about the behavior of whatever this is, piling up bones post-kill.
Yes.
Okay.
So there's actually, there's like three signatures to this. There's the teeth marks that result from feeding, and we haven't found too much of that next one. I think I found a couple where there could possibly be some teeth marks. But each one of us, if you look at how we eat things differently. So, but one of the main characteristics is the disarticulation of the ribs without busting them all to pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So they're still whole. They're not broken. And that's one of the characteristics. Another one is the stacking behavior. And that is like, you know, I like to use the example that if we were eating ribs or chicken or something like that, we'll eat the meat off the bones and lay them in a pile on the side of a plate. That is just behavior that we do. So it's similar to our behavior.
Okay. So let me play devil's advocate here, just to kind of figure out maybe from another side. So if these ribs are, you know, ripped off a kill and something is eating them, maybe even, and I'll just make this leap as well because I'm not a scientist, I can do these things. So one of these things grabs the ribs, goes to take a bite. Now, the impression that you saw, was it a bite through or was it a bite scrape, like they're scraping the meat off of the bone?
Well, we've found both, actually. The ones that were the easiest to measure and everything were actually on the side of the bone. And in each case, we got the impression of three teeth where they bit the side of the bone and actually broke small, you know, the chips off the side of the bone where the teeth contacted the bone. But in one place, and it's really neat because you can actually see the shape of the incisor that went through the bone.
Mm-hmm.
It went all the way through the bone, and you can actually see the shape of it. And it's more than anything else, it's shaped like a human incisor. So I guess you could say giant people are doing it if that's where you want to go.
Sure, sure. No, I know. And it's frustrating because you can't say Sasquatch, because then all of a sudden it's like, okay, you just made that leap all the way there, even though the research is great. No, I get what you're saying. So you'll have animals that will actually break bones to get the marrow. But then, okay, from a human behavior standpoint, we don't necessarily do that. At least I don't do that. I eat a rib, I'm good. I move it along. I eat a rib, I'm good. I move it along. It sounds like this behavior is similar in the sense that these bite marks don't appear to be in order to get the marrow from the bone. Or am I wrong there?
Well, some of the ribs had the ends chewed on it, and some of our further research shows that there's possible double arch structure from molars, possible triangular structure from premolars, which is similar to human type teeth.
Mm-hmm.
to me, that's, you know, it isn't questionable that the stuff is there, but they do chew on the end of the ribs, so I don't know exactly what they're trying to get out of that. But, you know, like we would use a toothpick or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
The ribs are still whole. It's just right on the ends, on the dorsal, no, on the ventral ends of the ribs.
Now, you can't make the assumption, though, that that's the same animal, correct? Because animals will scavenge. So it
yeah,
could
they
be
will.
A cougar or something, or a coyote or something, just grinding down the end of that to get whatever they're getting.
Yeah, that's a possibility. And some of the teeth marks that we find in those places don't match those animals, but that is a possibility. So,
sure.
The big incisor marks, I think those are most impressive evidence. In fact, the smaller ones that I found, one bone that I mentioned earlier, had mammillons. Those are the bumps on our teeth.
Okay.
They show up when our permanent teeth come in. In fact, I've still got some on my teeth. But you can see those bumps on the teeth of the smaller bite marks.
Okay.
But what I haven't been able to find out, that is a human characteristic, but I don't know if it's a primate characteristic or if any other animals also have that characteristic.
Okay.
I haven't been able to find that information.
So if you're looking at these ribs, and my thought would be, as we're talking, okay, how can these bite marks, these imprints, be a signature? Because if I'm biting into a bone, it's brittle, it's going to break, but that said, when these kills are made, those bones aren't nearly as hard. Is that right? I mean, are they still a little more malleable so that the teeth can actually sink in and leave more an impression, or am I going way down the wrong road here?
Well, green bone's a little bit softer than, say, seasoned bone would be. And we also, everything we eat mostly is cooked bones. So these haven't been cooked, so they're still a little bit soft. They aren't as brittle as a bone that's been laying out, say, for a long time.
Okay.
And, like I said, we did get the one bite-through mark. It was the shape of an incisor. It was just big. And this is kind of an aside, but I talked to David Ellis, and he had an imprint on a watermelon rind of incisors on it and actually cast them, and he sent me some pictures of them. I haven't got to see the actual cast yet, but actually you can see what shape the incisor is.
Okay.
And it's definitely something that's shaped like ours.
Now, do you have photographic evidence that you bounce off another one? So you have these photographs, and is there a source that you go back to kind of A-B these things and kind of come to some sort of conclusion that you have?
Well, everything I get, I photograph up close, try to get the best pictures I can, and I have a lot of really good pictures of these teeth marks in the bones. And I still have the bones, too, from the two elk kills we found. I've also got bones that I've collected that are suspicious from the X1 area, Chris's area. Up in the X1 area, we've found 24 2,000 kill sites, both elk and deer. You'd think there's bones laying all over, but they aren't always easy to find. But
sure.
We're covering an area that's at least a couple square miles, and there's lots of elk in there. So it is a good place for a predator to feed.
Now, let me ask you this question, too. So the bones themselves, they're in piles. Are they ever laid out in a intelligent way that's anything other than a pile? And I'm not saying that, you know, there's letters or X's or anything like that, but have you ever, you know, multiple piles spread out that would make you think that there's more than one of these things? Or, you know, what have you noticed?
Well, I'll put it this way. The freshest kills I've found were just a couple of months old. Those were the two elk kills that we found.
Yep.
So those bones hadn't been disturbed too much from the way they'd been laid down. And what it looked like to me is like behavior like we would do is something fed, and the stacking behavior was just a part of the feeding behavior. You eat something, you lay it down. Eat something, you lay it down on top of the other one. And, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what it looks like to me. Now, I haven't found anything unusual. All the stuff that we found in X1 that I could possibly attribute to Bigfoot, and I believe there was 4 or 5 of them out of the 24 that were possibilities. They were stacked. Those were older bones. They were at least a year old. So in that respect, it was a little bit harder to tell. They were stacked, and you could tell that by where all the bones, all the rib bones were located. It's the rib bones that I look for the most.
Mm-hmm.
And but to tell whether or not something was laid out specially or anything, like I say, it was such a long enough period of time they could have been disturbed. An elk could have walked through there and kicked them around too.
Sure, sure. So now, is that grade 8 behavior by any chance? Now, I know like chimpanzees will take meat every now and then, right? And they need it as part of their diet. They'll hunt. Is that in any way, whether it's vegetation, sticks, bones, whatever the case is that indicative of that type of behavior with great apes?
I've seen some chimpanzee kills, and they don't look quite the same. Chimpanzees don't feed quite the same as what we've seen. Like I say, what we've seen looks more human than it does anything else.
Gotcha.
More a human type behavior.
So let's go on to one of the next logical topics with this. So you've seen these, what appeared to be these intelligent, eating behaviors, stacking things when finished, whatever the case is, who knows why it's being done, But what other things have you seen in these different areas? Because I was at X1 with Chris a few months ago, just around the Sasquatch Summit time frame. He took me up to X1, and we saw a heck of a lot. Now, I've never seen elk kills before, but there were skulls all over the place. We saw footprints from various small animals and that sort of thing. I didn't see any stick structures, any of that stuff that people... But what is it that you've seen in the many years that you've been out in the field that you could say, okay, this bone pile thing plus this tooth signature, and there's other things going on that are purportedly Bigfoot behaviors. What does that look like? What have you seen?
Well, when we found the first elk kill, we were heading back to our camp after we'd found it. And we were going up over the ridge, and my son was a little bit ahead of me, and I was taking some pictures. And he looked down at the road. It was an old logging road that had logs across it and everything, so basically just a trail. And he looked down, and he found one big impression in the logging road. Well, he brought that to my attention, and I went over and looked at it. And the thing was 16 inches long and 7 inches wide across the ball of the foot. And I looked at that, and I thought, well, that's interesting. It was on the logging road. It was hard-packed ground, so it didn't sink into the dirt. But what it did sink into and smash down and leave an impression was the hemlock cones. They're little small cones.
Sure.
And they had been rained on the week previous, so that kind of gave me some idea of the age of the tracks, because the hemlock cones were wet, so they compressed when they got stepped on, and it left an impression. And we found 3 of them across that logging road. And they had a 6-foot step, which comes out to a 12-foot stride, which is big.
Yeah.
And I took I called a step stick and measured off 6 feet on it. And we actually backtracked the track maker back down towards the creek, down through a big huckleberry patch, which I think is the reason why it was probably in there, was probably feeding on huckleberries, and for about 100 yards. And then we lost it down near the creek, But so we were able to backtrack it that far. But we only had three tracks that we could actually tell what they looked like. The rest of it was broken sticks, scuff marks. We were able to track it, like I say, with the step stick, and we were able to backtrack it. So that's one thing I've found up in and also in that area. Before I even found any of the elk kills or anything, I found a lone 14-inch track and cast it, and you can even see where the toes, it was in the center of a logging road that I think was right after it was thawing out. You know how the ground gets soft?
Sure.
When it thaws?
Yep.
Otherwise, I don't think it would have left an impression. This idea that Bigfoot have to leave deep impressions, they've got about the same surface area per their size and weight as we do on ours, and we don't leave that many impressions unless we're walking in the mud. So I would say that Bigfoot's probably the same way. So
sure.
The idea that they always leave a deep impression where they go isn't true.
Well, by the way, never having been to the Pacific Northwest, and well, I had been to Seattle and some other places, but I'd never been out, you know, away from the populated areas. And when Chris took me out to X1, look, I know we weren't deep into the forest, but I was impressed by the, that's legitimate, wilderness. And for those of you who have not been out there, it's a little unsettling, especially at night. You know, we're walking through there, and there's moss hanging from the trees, and there's deep ferns, and you can't really see anything. And there's just a general quietness. And oh, by the way, then you have the mist that's on the ground. Oh. And, you know what I mean? And I'm sitting there going, all right, this is a kid who grew up in Southern California. Wait, I'm not used to this, A. And now, B, I'm in Bigfoot territory, so it's a little bit strange. But, yeah, you guys do good work out there. I know Chris had mentioned some of the things that you were doing in X1, and I was really impressed, and I'm sure you do the same thing, how methodical he was with how he changed the game cameras, repeating the process the same way every single time. And he had some really interesting ideas about how he approached the site and kind of the sameness with which he did it and backing out and not staying too long. What do you attribute that to, but do you kind of look at it the same way? If you're in a research area, do you want animals to know that there's a rhythm to when you come in and out so they're kind of comfortable, or are you kind of disturb it, come in at different times and get what you can get?
Well, I know that we don't do it all at the same time all the time, because a lot of it depends on our work schedules.
Sure.
How we can get in and how often we can get into the area. But I don't like disturbing things anymore, and I have to. We have been working on different ideas for cameras, because that's just my own personal opinion, is that I think that Bigfoot is able to see the cameras out there. It's not any special trait that they have or anything. I guess you could say it's special because they're able to notice things around in their environment. And cameras tend to stand out, and it doesn't make any difference whether they're camouflaged or not. As far as factory camouflage goes, cameras stand out. They don't fit the environment, and I just think that it's a good possibility that Bigfoot can recognize the cameras out there that are not part of their environment.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. So, no, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. You look at camera. Look, Chris sends me things all the time from his cameras, and you'll see an elk looking right at the camera, or some other small animal looking right at the camera. And I don't know if it's the functionality of they can hear the machinery as small as it is, or any kind of frequency coming out of there. That's the thing that gets me, right? There's two things. One is we're not getting – well, there's three things. One is we're not getting Sasquatch on camera because they don't exist. Okay, that's one thing.
Yeah.
The second thing is we're not getting them on camera because they can actually see them and are kind of like, what's that? And they tend to stay away. and then maybe we don't have the cameras going off because the range is too far. Or the third, and I think most likely, I'd like to get your take on this, disagree or agree, is we're not going out far enough. And see, I have this theory, and it's just a theory, that as far as we think we're going into the woods, and as far as we think we're penetrating, we're not really going either that far or far enough. And I think it's a function of one thing. We have to change camera film or batteries or whatever the case is, SD cards. You're not going to want to trek out 10 miles the next week, come back and trek out another 10 miles. Do you agree with that, or am I way off base?
Well, you know, that I think that's a good possibility. I also think your second example is a good possibility, too. Most game cameras really aren't designed for the kind of work we're putting them to when it comes to Sasquatch, because their ranges are so short. They cover very little area. One of my favorite cameras is, it's called a Plot Watcher. It's actually a time-lapse camera. That camera takes a picture as far as it can see. Now, sometimes it's going to be hard to identify something when it's 70 yards away from the camera, but you're getting a picture of something that you wouldn't have gotten with a regular camera.
Okay. Okay.
And it doesn't have any kind of triggers on it. It doesn't have flash. It only takes daytime, which is kind of a limitation. But from what I've heard, Sasquatch sightings are about 50-50 between day and night. So sounds like you got as much chance of one being out in the daytime as at nighttime.
Sure.
So they don't have flashes to give themselves away, and since they've got such a long range on them, they can see things that other cameras can't see. And you're right about animals noticing them. We do try to camouflage our cameras. We use cloth on them. We use other methods to camouflage our cameras so they just don't look like a box on a tree. But the squirrels, they get into the camel cloth and rip it off, the stuff that we use. The elk, I've had them walk right up and pull it right off of the camera. I don't know what it is that they're seeing or hearing or smelling, but they do notice cameras. And this is just regular animals.
Mm. Okay. So, yeah, it could be, well, like bears will smell when they break into a home. They go nuts for that foam or whatever it is inside a refrigerator door. You know, there's certain smells that even though they're not necessarily going to eat something, they're attracted by it very strongly.
Yeah.
So maybe it's the plastic, maybe it's the chemicals that it's made by. I have no idea. A question came to mind as you were, and we'll get back. I want to get into equipment here in a second. My theory is, and I was doing this when I was out there, how often should we be looking up when we're walking through the woods?
Well, I probably don't look up as much as I should, but a lot of like the Arion X1, it's all second growth timber. Some of it's not that big. So I suppose if you're suggesting that Bigfoot climbs trees, you know, I don't have any problem with that thought, but it's probably the smaller ones that do it, unless you're in a forest like up in the National Forest where the trees are actually bigger.
Sure.
But it is a possibility because we don't look up very often. Very few animals actually look up that often. That was one of my, you were talking about equipment there. That's one of the things, our equipment is that we're making hangers to hang our cameras up 16 feet in a tree out of the line of sight, which it's kind of hard to service those cameras. I carry a pole around with me, and I've gotten a lot of good pictures. At least the animals aren't messing with the cameras except the squirrels and the birds. But
sure.
It's hard to service. It takes a while to service them.
What kind of, for audio, what are you using to record? What kind of recorder?
Well, that's, like I say, that's Chris's specialty. He used a Tascam, I believe, but I really couldn't tell you much about that. I don't do a lot of recording. I do the the game cameras, and I have various game cameras. Some of them work better than others. Some of them have longer ranges. Some of them have invisible flash, which I think is probably a good thing, but we don't know for sure what can see any wavelength of light. So, you know, as far as we call them invisible because we can't see them.
Right, right, exactly. And it's kind of it's kind of an assumption to think that nothing else can as well. So, do you have now? Let me ask you this question: on the Bigfoot Ground Zero website, is there anything that you wouldn't mind posting that I could put up for listeners to check out with regard to your research? And I can also, and I think you're working on a website now. When that's finished, I can point folks to your website if they come in and check out, you know, the research and that sort of thing. Do you have anything that you can do? Or,
well, when we get that website done, Chris or I could give you the link to that.
Okay.
And I think people will probably find it informative. We're trying to do it in such a way that it actually puts information out there, how we do what we do, how Chris does the audio, how I make comparisons on the bones and what I look for. And that's what this website's going to include. So I think people would find it interesting and useful for their own research.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've also given you a link to the analysis that I wrote, which you can post there in your blog if you want to.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, feel free if you ever want to write a blog, you know, a few hundred words on a topic or whatever, send it my way. I'm more than happy to post it. And again, send a link back to yours so you get that web traffic as well. So, well, we're up against time right now. It's almost an hour that we've been going at it. I know, it's crazy. It goes by quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So let's do this. I'd love to have you back another time, maybe in a few months. You've got some more research going on, and you know, I'm sure the listeners would like it as well. I'm sure I'm going to get a ton of great email on this. And if there's anybody wanting to get in touch with you, I will forward that along. And again, folks, you can reach me at bigfootgroundzero@gmail.com. I'm more than happy to get you in touch with Gerald. But at this point, Gerald, thanks so much. I appreciate it. And I think we'll call it a night, and we'll be in touch down the road.
Okay, well, I'm glad that I could share some of what I do.
Absolutely. All right, take care, my man.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bigfoot Ground Zero is a part of the Bigfoot Worldwide Radio Network.
chandam, chandam, chandam.